Hi, I'm Sam Edis.
And I'm Amy Nelson. Welcome to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
This is a show about the world's most remarkable women, their professional and personal journeys.
Together, we'll hear from gold medalists, best-selling authors, and leaders of the world's most iconic brands. Today, we're thrilled to welcome Suzanne Simard onto the show. She's a forest scientist, and 5 million people have watched her TED Talks. She's also the author of Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest.
So, Suzanne, when did you first fall in love with trees?
I think that a child is surrounded by love from the moment they're born, but falling in love with trees was just a natural thing because I grew up right around them, right in the forest. And so they were just part of the fabric of my life. I loved my family. I loved my trees.
When you say that you grew up in the forest, what exactly does that mean? Paint a picture for us of what your childhood was like.
Yeah. So my parents came from the inland rainforest. And so that's where we spent, even though we didn't live exactly in it all the time, we spent all of our summers and springs and falls in these rainforests. What is a rainforest? They're full of big trees, first of all. And in our case, they were cedars and hemlocks. So these giant cathedrals of forests and full of like lots of different plants and animals. They're just really complex and amazing places. But I never thought of it that way because that's just where I grew up. But they are like those iconic old growth rainforests.
Wow.
But they were on the interior. They're not on the coast. It's in the interior. Where I grew up is more like closer to the Rocky Mountains. And so as the weather moves across the mountains, it dumps a lot of rain in those areas. And so that's what creates these inland rainforests.
What does it mean to spend a day in the rainforest? So you would wake up as a child and explain that relationship to us.
Well, so in the summers when we were at my grandparents on my dad's side, we were in a place called Maple Lake, and we actually lived on a houseboat, a logger's houseboat, right on the lake. So right in this beautiful, huge lake full of soft, ploppy water. I say ploppy because it rained a lot, and I always remember the plop, plop, plop sound of the rain on the lake. And of course, on the leaves, in the bush, you know, the big devil's club and the big leaves of the understory plants. It was wet and rainy, and not all the time, also sunny days, but we would live on this houseboat that was built by my grandfather for housing loggers who logged in the area. And in the summers, my family would move in, and it was moored on the shore of Cottonwood Bay at Maple Lake. And so we spent half our time in the water and half our time in the forest on the shore and, you know, just playing like as I was a kid. And my brother and sister and I would, you know, we especially loved making rafts, and we would make these rickety old rafts with old logs that have fallen from the forest and then go around and to different bays and creeks and just play and make forts and play in the bush. That's what it was like.
It sounds so idyllic. I mean, Amy and I are now raising our kids among so many screens. That sounds like a fantasy way to grow up, was it?
Well, it wasn't to me because that's all I knew. But now I realize like most kids don't get to grow up that way now. But they, you know, my kids, for example, they did grow up in the forest around here. Not quite as idyllic as my childhood, but because they grew up in the screen era as well. And they need to know those things. But they still have their life outside. So I think that it's still pretty idyllic for sure.
You're known as the person who discovered that trees talk to each other. How did that happen?
Well, I wasn't the only person who's discovered it. I'll just say that off the bat. You know, people have looked at it in various ways, and I've certainly been one of those people. But what I looked at, what I have discovered in my work is that in a forest, that the trees are all connected together by these special fungi that are, they're called mycorrhizal fungi, and they're kinds of fungi that help trees or help plants. They're called mutualists. That means that the tree or the plant provides photosynthate in exchange for nutrients and water that the fungus gets from the soil. So it's a mutualistic relationship, and they connect plants together. And through those fungal highways, trees and plants pass nutrients and water back and forth between them. And so that's a kind of communication. That's the talking that people talk about when they say, oh, you discovered how trees talk to each other. And when I say I'm not the only one, it's because other people are looking at this as well in different systems around the world. I was just the first one to discover it in forests. The other mode of conversation between trees, in addition to these below ground fungal highways or telephone lines, you could think of them, we now know too that trees, and I didn't do this research, other people actually in California and Oregon did this work, where they actually communicate through the air. And so trees will emit or send off chemical signals that are, they're called volatile organic chemicals or compounds. And, you know, they're the smells that you smell in the forest when you walk in the forest. They're signals, and they can signal each other whether there's any kind of danger in the woods, like if there's an infestation by insects, they can warn their neighbors, even the same species or different species of these sort of enemies in the forest, or at least these herbivores. So that's another mode of communication that I haven't studied, but that has been going on kind of parallel to my own work at the same time.
They warn them how?
So when a tree is injured, so for example, I specifically looked at these budworms, or my students did, that are natural enemies or herbivores in the forest. The budworms chew on the needles of Douglas firs and pines and so on, especially Douglas fir, which is what I studied. And the Douglas fir, when it gets chewed on like that, or even when if you went with a pair of scissors and clipped off the needles, which we did as well, the trees respond, right? It's like if somebody punched you in the face, you would go, oh, and you would go, oh, my jaw, you know, and have a response. Trees have a response too, and it's a hormonal biochemical response. And it triggers that chewing by an herbivore, triggers a biochemical cascade of reactions that basically, you know, starts in the leaves and ends up in the roots. And what we found is that these warnings or these chemicals would then emit through the mycorrhizal network and into other neighbors. So then the neighbors would receive those messages, and it actually triggered them to upregulate defense genes. So this is in their genetics, their RNA, actually. They would upregulate their RNA and start producing defense enzymes. And then those enzymes protected that neighbor against herbivores that would attack it. So, you know, you could attack those neighbors then that were upregulated with the same insect, and they were able to resist that attack. Some people call it a warning and aid system. So the attacked plant warns its neighbors and helps them. That's the warning and aid. But others kind of think of it as the neighboring plant eavesdropping on the status of the donor or the attack plant. And so, you know, which is it? Is it a warning system or is it an eavesdropping system? I think it's a combination of both. Like both plants are involved in this communication that's going on.
So it's funny that you kind of downplay, oh, I just discovered it in forests. Like it's still pretty extraordinary, right? For those of us that are not in your field, what are the sort of domino effects of understanding this? What other things does that lead to?
That's a really good question. Those domino effects are still happening. So at first, when I first did this work, I mean, it was exciting because, you know, I was the first one to show that this kind of networking and transmission of resources, this communication occurs in real forests. Prior to that, there had been some work done in the United Kingdom by a scientist called David Reed, who had looked in the laboratory and found, you know, that these mycorrhizal fungi could connect pine seedlings in little pots in the lab, and that carbon could move from one to another. So we already knew that, but I took that sort of lab study and said, does this actually exist or occur in real ecosystems? And I've always worked in forests, so naturally that's where I tested this. And so when I did that work, I basically kind of verified what David Reed had found, but took it that, you know, several steps further. I verified it happened in forests. I found out that these communication is a two-way communication. It's not just one plant sending resources to another. It's actually they go back and forth, that these plants are in a tango, right? They're in a conversation. And I also was able to figure out, you know, that plants are kind of our main drivers of this. They kind of have control over this. I found that when I shaded a plant, that more carbon went to it. It wasn't the fungus itself that was controlling it. It was the plants. But I mean, really, in nature, everything works together, you know, the plants, the fungi, the soil. So I'm sure that, you know, further studies and have verified since then that the fungi actually are involved in this communication as well. Okay, so then what happened? I got that published in Nature, which was a big deal. So there was a lot of attention, good and bad. So a lot of good attention because it got, you know, public. But there was a lot of skepticism about my work. And I think there still is, right? Like, so the main skepticism that came up in the academic world was they just kind of started picking apart my work, right? Saying, well, you didn't do this right and you didn't do that right. And so I actually, at that point in my career, I was in my mid-30s at that point. I kind of got really turned off by it, by this constant harassment, you know, this nitpicking of my work. And I could see that it was a debate that had been going on for quite a while by between other researchers. And I was sort of like, I kind of stumbled into it. And I thought, I don't want to do this anymore.
Wow.
And I was having my children at that time. So it was doubly stressful. And then even the forest industry and the government who I worked for, they were also very negative about it, right? They thought, oh, I'm trying to get them to change what they do and I'm being too critical and you know, and I shouldn't be criticizing government policy. And anyway, so at that point, I was just like, you know what? I don't know if it's worth it personally for me to keep pursuing this. And then, you know, my kids grew up a little bit. I got a different job in academia. And when I got to academia, that was the place where I could actually make my mark, was to continue that work. So when you get into academia, instead of government scientists, you actually have to continue progressing your science. Whereas in government or industry, you're supporting their policy, basically. That's your science, is to support their policy. So it was quite a different mindset. So I had more freedom. I still was, you know, I was interested in it, of course, but I was also still really, you know, the questions were so, I don't know, it was stalled. I think the whole field became stalled because people were still didn't believe that these networks existed. They didn't believe that it had any effect on plants, even though the evidence was gathering. But I continued like little bit with my students and slowly built the story over the next decade. So that's when I was in my 40s. And other labs in the world started taking it up and making breakthroughs. And then I thought, okay, you know, now I can continue on with this.
Because you weren't a lone ranger.
I wasn't the lone ranger. Yeah. In fact, there was in China, where at that time they were investing more in their research than we were in, I don't know, there was seemed to be a shift in where the hotspots of research were in the world. And the Chinese were investing in their research in agriculture and forestry. And they made this big great breakthrough that these networks exist, these plants are not only sending resources back and forth, but they're warning each other about these dangers. So that warning and aid system was actually developed by a postdoc who came to work with me, and she started out with tomato plants. And then we moved that work into the forests and said, does this happen in forests? And so when that happened, I felt like the whole thing kind of relaxed, and I was able to ask more and more questions without so much negative criticism.
You've talked about how at certain times it was hard to get funding for your research. How did you overcome that? And just, I have to ask, do you think it was different because you're a woman scientist and it's, I feel like science is still a largely male-dominated field?
Yeah. I mean, funding is always hard to get, right? As a scientist, it's like one of the jobs you have. We all have multiple jobs. That's, as a scientist, you know, you get funding, you do your research, you publish your research, you teach, you contribute to the community. So that funding part is just a major part of our jobs. And the success rate of funding, no matter who you are, male or female, is low often. So you can apply for grants where you get, there's like a 10 or 15% success rate. And so it can get really discouraging if you've got rejections after rejection and you've put all that effort in. I would say that overall, I've been pretty successful. I've been happy with my success. I don't feel like in the funding that there's discrimination against me because I'm female. I think that there's other things where there is. I think that there's definitely things I can point to where I feel like my femaleness has created complexity, but I don't think the funding part is part of it. I'm fortunate in that way.
What are those areas that you would point to?
You know, I think part of it, well, when it comes to application of the work and acceptance of it, the things that we just talked about, I think that that early criticism of my work, you know, all of those scientists were men, almost all of them. And I think that they were, even though they might not have said in their minds, oh, you know, Suzanne came in and did this and stole my thunder or showed what I wasn't finding, I think there was some of that going on in that, right? You can't help but think of it because they're all men, right? And you're right. The woman. And so I think it's a natural thing to feel that. And so, and I think that exists. And then when it comes to the application of the work, I've heard all the things said behind my back, right? Like, you know, this fairy, fairy, mystical, who would ever think that trees talk to each other? Good grief. I mean, people say that today, right? I don't think they would have criticized me quite as much if I was a man. And then, of course, how I respond is also important. You know, when I first started receiving these criticisms, I didn't really know how to handle it. And this I'm trying to teach my students is how to have a thick skin, right? How do you deal with those criticisms that you know are a little bit underhanded? And it is a skill.
I think what's so shocking, I think for me and Amy probably listening to this is, you know, you would think, we know this happens in business. We know like certain industries are cutthroat, but we wouldn't expect that, you know, forestry and the study of trees could also be so cutthroat. And I think it just shows us that there's always going to be cynics. There's always going to be kind of haters, we call them. And how you manage the reaction to that is probably similar across all of these different fields. So how did you manage?
So at first it was really hurtful and I wanted to hide and leave the field. And especially because I was having my children, which is normal for women, that they're going through this stuff while they're having their children. And my reaction was, I don't want anything to do with this. I just want to raise my kids. And then I had a great boss, a man, Alan Vise, and he protected me in so many ways and advocated for me. And that was so important. I don't think I would have survived without him. So girls, you know, coming up and women coming up through these fields need that, right? They need that support and camaraderie. And I think as women, especially, you know, when you're in a field like forestry, you're like one of the few and you don't have that network around you because you're the only one. It just makes it a million times harder. And so, you know, I learned from Alan, like him mentoring me and modeling to me as a man, like a real, you know, a real man. Like he wasn't really thinking about that, I don't think, so much as protecting me, but I learned so much from it. And then I've taught my students. And so it's so important, you know, to emulate or to model to your students the strength and how to show strength when you're dealing with controversy and criticism. And so over the years, yeah, I got hurt many, many, many times and I still get hurt. But now I feel like I have enough support around me and I'm confident with what I've found because we've just repeated the experiment so many times and in so many labs around the world. And that, yes, there are still gaps in our knowledge, but I know that, you know, this is part of science and we just keep building. It's the mentorship, right? This is what's been missing for women is the mentorship is slowly coming on. And then just that network of, you know, like my male colleagues, you know, they just won't teach that extra course or they just will not pay attention to that criticism or they'll just go talk to their buddy and say, ah, they don't have to deal with it like we do, right? We have to learn it from scratch. And we have to find our mentors, and there's not very many of them out there. So we got to, you know, find the mentors, find the support, and then build your skin and do good work.
And now for a quick break.
One thing that's really interesting, kind of in juxtaposition of talking about self-doubt or, you know, being held back, is that you have taken something that seems inaccessible to a lot of people, which is forest science, ecology, right? And you have translated it in a way that is just mesmerizing through, I think, largely, you know, now you have a book, but before TED Talks. How did you come about doing your first TED Talk? How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I grew up a really shy kid to the point I could hardly speak, right? Like I was so afraid to even speak. And I'll get to the story quickly, but I got to high school and I couldn't speak in public or anything. I was so afraid. And I remember then getting into university and I had to do this speaking presentation where, and the instructor didn't know what he was doing, but what he would do is he'd say, okay, get up on the stage and I'm going to give you one word and you need to give a talk. And so I got up on the stage and my word was dog. Like it couldn't get any easier than that. I had a dog and I got up there and I froze and I was so embarrassed and humiliated. And I went and sat down and I was just like, and then I sat to myself, you know, in the evening and I said, you can't go through life this way. you have to overcome this. And so I would say, just imagine yourself doing well and be prepared next time. You know, being prepared was super important for me. I couldn't do it off the cuff like that. And so I just gradually made myself do more and more and more. And I wasn't very good at it at first, right? Like, you have to learn that skill. You have to put the time in and be prepared. And then I remember one time I gave this talk and I thought I was terrible. And this guy said, you know, you were really good at that. And I thought, but it was so important that he said that to me, right? And I'll always remember that, that he did that little bit of encouragement. And then eventually, you know, I got asked to do this TED talk and I had just actually got asked and then I got cancer. And so I had to actually cancel the talk the first time I got asked because I couldn't go to New York. I was in chemo. And I remember writing to them and I said, well, I could try, but I'm bald. And they said, okay, let's just put it off for now. And so then they rebooked me for the next year and I went to New Orleans and I gave a TED Youth talk. And I was so afraid and my hair was, you know, I had lost all my hair, but it was growing back. It had come in silver, like it was gray and it was really short. And I was so self-conscious. And I was also had chemo brain and I couldn't remember the words. Chemo brain, it makes you like you can't remember anything. It's like having dementia. And so my girlfriend, Mary, we went to New Orleans and we stayed in that hotel room and she made me practice over and over and over and over again. I must have practiced my talk 100 times. And she's just like, I'm so sick of this, but I'm going to make you do it one more time. And I managed to get up on that stage and do it. And I remember too that the TED guy, I can't remember his name, but he was so enthusiastic. And as soon as my talk was done, he jumped up and he shouted and he said, yay, because he knew how hard it was for me to do that. And that little bit of encouragement, I went, oh, thank goodness. And then I got asked to go to the big TED stage, which was amazing, right? And again, I worked really, really hard on that. And I got my brother-in-law, who is a cinematographer, Bill Heath, and he helped me with the story, creating the script. That took a long time. I worked with the TED people. And then Mary came with me again, my partner. Aww. And we went to Banff and we got a hotel room for a week. And she made me practice and practice and practice until she was so sick of it again. And I went up and did it.
How did it feel when you were on stage and people are literally cheering when they hear, you know, kind of the, I was watching one of your TED Talks and and you get to the point where you're like, so trees do talk and people are just cheering. How did that feel?
It was great. It was so amazing. You know what the most amazing moment was in that TED Talk? I mean, the cheering was great, but I got about halfway through and my mind went blank. And you don't see this in the recording of the TED Talk, right? Because they edited that out. But my mind went blank. I was so scared. And I stood there and I looked at the audience and I could see Mary out there and she was grasping her seat going. And the people in the front row were going, you know, you can do it. You can do it. And then all of a sudden I remembered and I just kept going.
Oh, wow.
And you would never know looking at it, right?
No, not
That's
at all.
That's incredible.
TED Talks are terrifying to give, but you have to be organized and just memorize your talk and just go do it.
Yep. And Mary had the right hunch, which was the more you do it, the easier it'll be. So tell us about your family life.
Well, I have 2 daughters, Hannah and Nava. They're 23 and 21 now. And so I raised my kids with my husband, Don, and we split up, you know, when they were 12 and 14. And right at the time, I got cancer. So a lot happened at that time. And so then at that point, you know, we were in 2 separate households. But up until then, we were just a regular family, except that it wasn't really regular because I was working and living in Vancouver. And my family lived in Nelson, which was 9 hours away. It wasn't always like that, but Don and I were, when I went to the university, and I described this in my book, but I got the job at the university and he didn't want to go, which, you know, he just didn't want to live in the big city and he didn't want me working all the time and he could see it. And so he was really resistant, but eventually relented and we went, but he still hated it there. So we lasted 4 years in the city and then we moved to Nelson, which is where I grew up, basically. I grew up in this area. This is the rainforest I grew up in. He loved it too. And so then at that point, I started doing this commute. And so my family life was like, I think I described it as time-lapse photography, because I had to be teaching in Vancouver during the week and then getting home to my kids on the weekends and trying to juggle this. And it was really, really hard. And I remember thinking, you know, this isn't how I imagine I would raise my family. Like, I just wanted to be there all the time, but I also couldn't imagine giving up my career and all the work I was, you know, my discoveries. It was just an impossible choice. And so I thought, well, I can do it. I can do everything, right? I can do it all. And I tried, and I did, but then I got sick, right? It made me sick because it was too much.
Right. Wow. And did you ever consider having the kids with you in Vancouver and having Dawn stay in Nelson?
You know, we went through a lot of fights about that. Yes, that was part of the conversation. In the end, we decided that I would do this commuting and he would go with the girls. And so how did that decision come about? It was a long process and it was very difficult and it made me ill, really. Honestly, it made me ill.
Wow.
You know, the choices are so hard. It's so hard.
Oh my gosh, it makes me cry.
If I look back and would I have done it again? I don't know, you know.
How do your girls look at your career now?
You know, I asked my girls a few years ago, I said, oh, yeah, this was really funny. When they were applying to go to university and Hannah had to write this essay on, you know, challenges in her life, like what were the hard things in her life? And she said, Mom, I don't know what they want because I don't think I've had any challenges in my life. And I was like, well, you could talk about that. You know, your mom wasn't there part of the time. And she says, actually, I'm proud of that we were like that. I wouldn't change anything. And so I think the girls are fine, right? I am who I am and they are who they are.
Not only fine, but they're clearly super proud of you, right? That goes beyond fine. That's pretty extraordinary.
They're beyond fine.
Yeah.
In fact, and now they're both following in my footsteps. They're both studying for us at university.
Oh, that's amazing.
I love that. That's incredible. Yeah. Wow.
I think that as moms that, you know, we feel like we make all these mistakes and we do make mistakes and we make choices that maybe, I don't know, maybe sometimes it's not the right choice. But I mean, we always say this, it's a cliche, kids are resilient. They are resilient within certain bounds. And, you know, I think that I really pushed the boundaries, but they were still okay.
It's a great lesson.
You've brought up cancer a few times. How did you manage getting through that while you continued to work, while you continued to raise your kids?
Yeah, it was really tough. So I got cancer and I, you know, I had to talk to the kids and so did my husband. And really, Dawn was really great with this, right? Dawn is a really positive father and very involved in their lives. And he just said to them, you know, Mom's going to be okay. And he said that to me too. You're going to be okay. You're tough. And of course, I had lots of doubts. Anybody would, right? It's a, you know, it's a deadly disease and people die from it. And I could die from it too, you know. But I got to this point partway through my treatments where, you know, my doctor was very good and my family was right here and Mary was here and my friends. And I thought, you know, as long as I have support, even if I die, it's okay. You know, I got to that point. And once I got to that point, it got easier. Like I wasn't so fearful. And then, you know, when I got to the point where I finished the chemo and, you know, and my doctor said, Suzanne, you know, it might come back, it might not, but you're just going to have to embrace this thing, this mystery of life. And so somehow I managed to do that. And I've carried it with me. And it's also informed my work, right? Like I started asking different questions in my work because I understood my mortality better and what it meant to me as a human being. What does your mortality mean? And what do you want to leave behind? How do you want to contribute to this world? What can you do? And so I just became more focused on asking the right questions that mattered to me. And it turned out that intuition and that thought was important. You know, it was important for me to pay attention to my experience and bring my experience to my science.
Tell us about Mary.
So she would go, oh, don't say anything. Mary's my partner. We don't live together. She lives in Oregon. She's a chemist. She's retired now. And We're similar, right? She loves the outdoors and she's a good listener. I think that's, what else can I say about her?
How did you meet?
So when I was a graduate student at Oregon State, Dawn and I had a duplex and our next door neighbor was Mary.
Huh.
And so we got to be friends, but nothing, there was no, I mean, I was married to Dawn. I went on to have children with Dawn and Mary and I remained friends. But I moved back to Canada, and so we just had sort of like this distant relationship, or, you know, friendship. And then, you know, as my marriage started to fall apart, because the strain was too much, right? It was too much to be commuting. The marriage couldn't last under those conditions. And so then, you know, as it was coming to a close, Mary had reached out to me, and we just started doing stuff together, you know, going for hikes, and it was really healing for me. And then, you know, that's how it happened. I mean, it was unexpected. It's a beautiful thing. And I love her very much. And we're still together. And now it's kind of hard because I haven't seen her for almost, you know, since the beginning of COVID.
Yeah.
She lives across the border. I live in Canada. So we see each other is on Zoom right now. But I'm hopeful that that will come to an end soon. But we're one of those couples that got caught, you know,
in different places. Yeah. Oh, that's brutal.
Yeah. It would have been more brutal if we were 20, but, you know, we're 60. We're both 60 now, so mature about it.
So what is next for you in terms of your research? What are you hoping to discover?
Well, you know, I'm a very practical and applied person, which which means that I like my work to have meaning and to have traction. And so I started this project called the Mother Tree Project with my best friend, who is Jean Roach. She's another forester. We've been friends since we were 20. And she manages the project and I lead it. And it's basically taking all of the things we found out about tree communication and kinship and transmitting resources and signals and information and knowledge and applying it in real forestry. So it's how do you protect mother trees, which are the center of the forest, the center of the connections, so that they continue to help heal the land. And the practice now generally is clear cut, which means take all the big trees. You know, people love the big trees because they bring lots of income. They're valuable. You can make big things from them. So they're the first thing that people or foresters want to cut down, but they're also the most important part of the network. And they're also really important for all kinds of ecosystem functions, including carbon storage and biodiversity and like the big things that make forests work. And so I'm trying to get them to shift away from clear cutting to saving these big old trees. You can still harvest trees, but save the big ones so that they can bootstrap the ecosystem back to, you know, to recover. And so that's an uphill battle because it's really hard to change a practice. Right. It would be like telling like Big Ag not to use fertilizers and herbicides because they've always done that, at least for the past 50 years in forestry. It's the same. We've always clear cut. Well, I'm saying you need to leave these big old trees behind because they're the legacy. That's what moves the ecosystem forward. They've got the genes that live through those past climate upheavals. They've got the mycorrhizas that are the old growth mycorrhizas. They house these old plants that we need to fill niches. And so it's a completely different way of managing and viewing forests. So anyway, I wanted to show people by having this experiment, I wanted to show them that you could do things differently. And I wanted to demonstrate, or I wanted to find out, how do we keep these trees in different patterns and amounts and configurations in different kinds of forests that had different climate regions or climatic pressures so that the forest would be resilient as they go forward. And so this project is called the Mother Tree Project. I spend most of my time on it. Almost all my grad students now are working on that. It's the biggest experiment I've ever done. So that's one main focus. The other main focus is I'm working with some Aboriginal people on cycling of nitrogen and salmon-derived nitrogen in forests and what that means to forest productivity. And also just how, you know, that connection between people and trees and fungi and salmon is so important. Those connections are so important. And when you sever those connections, things fall apart. And in that project, we call it the Salmon Forest Project. You know, basically, you know, the salmon management by, you know, our governments is really broken, and our salmon populations have plummeted to, you know, a few percent of pre-colonization levels. And the thing is that the Aboriginal people had really sustainable ways of managing salmon through their fishing technologies, and they actually enhanced salmon populations through their technologies. Whereas, you know, our modern fisheries, our, you know, the colonization fisheries have decimated it. It's just like not taken a holistic approach at all. You know, it's due to, you know, climate change and damming of the rivers and destroying habitat. And there's, you know, many reasons. And so I'm working with the Aboriginal people to try and bring attention to that there are different ways to do things. You know, there are more conservationist ways that actually enhance the resources, enhance the salmon, and then the salmon enhance the forests. But if we break those linkages, if we break the cycle, we break the system. But the system is resilient. It is inherently resilient, but we can actually really crash the system if we're really exploitive, which is what we're doing. And so, yeah, I want to, demonstrate that there are other ways to do things in the land.
And now for a quick break.
All right, Aim, you want to start the lightning round?
What book are you reading right now?
I'm reading several, but Sapiens is one of them.
If you weren't studying trees, you would be studying...
glaciers, because they're dynamic and I love to be on them. They're disappearing and they hold clues to past climates, and they'll help us understand future climates and how to deal with them.
Where is one place in the world you've wanted to travel but have not yet visited?
Well, I've always wanted to go to Old Crow. Old Crow is in the Yukon. It's in the Mackenzie Plateau, or the Mackenzie Delta. It's up above the Arctic Circle. It's where the first human habitation record of it in North America is. But it's an indigenous community. It's a Gwich'in community. They're very much one with the land, and they're very much affected by climate change. And there's a little story that I just love from the Gwich'in people that I read to my students. So anyway, I've always wanted to go there.
Who leaves you starstruck?
Rachel Maddow. I love Rachel Maddow. I've started listening to her during the Trump period, because I didn't know about her before that. And I thought, this woman knows her shit. And she is so good on camera, and she's so personable and so well-researched, and her compass is set right, at least according to me. I admire her. She's got a thick skin. I can learn from her.
I like that.
Lou's been listening this whole time, and he offers the male perspective on the show. So he comes in with a final question.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Lou.
So I actually have a friend who she's been called crazy by her family, by her friends, and she's a musician. She's very talented. But she went to Joshua Tree, and she's now started to study trees. And everybody thinks she's crazy because she said exactly what you said, that they can talk. But you mentioned something that really stuck with me, and I'm wondering, why aren't humans starting to see the correlation with keeping the planet the way it's supposed to be that would benefit us in the long run? Why do you think that these people are not listening to your information and to your work?
You know, I think a lot of people are listening, actually, but it hasn't gained traction. That's what you're getting at. Like, why isn't it actually affecting policy and practices? And why isn't our environmental climate change being, why aren't we solving this problem? And to me, there are clear ways to do this. And why aren't we acting on it? And people, lots of people talk about this, like we've evolved to deal with sudden problems, right? Immediate problems. And climate change is a long-term problem. And when you have such a global problem, it's hard to wrap your head around, what do you do? And so there's that, but there's also, like, you know, people get stuck in the way they do things, right? Like, we've always done it this way. We've always clear cut. We've always, you know, and it's hard to change the momentum of that infrastructure and that old way of thinking. But it happens piece by piece. It does happen. And I think that, you know, all of the media attention, the books, the TED Talks, these interviews, is all part of changing minds. And I study systems, right? I study ecosystems. And systems are built on relationships between different parts. So like in a society, we have systems too, right? Our society is based on our relationships. It's the same thing in all systems, ecosystems too. It's on relationships between all the parts. And the way that change happens is it's slow relationships that are kind of constantly adjusting, and you can get building slow level changes, almost inaudible, almost imperceptible. And then suddenly you can get these tipping points where the system will start to change really rapidly. So putting in, you know, the right policies and the right practices in place, you know, climate policy where we're trying to decarbonize the future, or we change land use changes. We say we're not going to cut down old growth forests anymore. Simple policies get put in place and people start to make changes. And then all of a sudden there's a big shift. And so I think we're in that slow phase right now where people are just kind of catching on and saying, oh yeah, you know what? There are other ways to do things, and we're going to pressure our governments. And watch, Joe Biden just said, we're not going to have any more, you know, combustion engines on the roads after 2030 or 2035. Those are all super important changes. And we all get on, you know, if we can get on board with the positive changes, then it affects big change. So I think it's coming. It's slow. I think we got to keep pushing, right? We keep all these little things matter. All the little interviews, all the policies people are putting in place around the world, even COVID matters, right? Because it showed us that we can affect change at a global scale. We can do it.
Do you think your mother tree research will help fuel the change?
I think it can. I think that it's one part of it. You know, there's other places that demonstrations are needed, but the mother tree research, if people become aware of it, then they can, you know, push for those changes. The mother tree research itself won't affect any change, right? It's the attention to it that makes the difference. Like we can do, like I always say, like I can do lots of science. I could just spend my whole life in the academic world in my little office and churn out tons of journal articles. I can get lots of, you know, recognition and rewards and all that stuff. But it might never get any attention if I don't do that next thing, which is get the word out. That's what you guys do, and I'm part of that too. That part is just as important. So the mother tree research, yeah, we're getting great stuff. We're getting really cool information. Like if you clear cut a forest, you lose half the carbon right off the bat. Like it seems like a no-brainer, but we've published the paper showing that. And if we can get the word out, then people will pressure their governments to change. And that's happening, right? I think that this, what we're doing here with the book and the TED Talks and all that, it is motivating change in how people think. And one thing we didn't talk about is the mother tree research, or the about connection and collaboration in communities. In traditional forestry, the focus has been so much on how do you manage competition in these forests. So, you know, the way we manage, you know, weeding and pruning and trying to cultivate the dominant trees, and, you know, treating each tree as a competitor that's out to make its own way to be a self-made tree. And all of our forestry practices are geared around this, right? To create more space for those dominant trees. And it's very, you know, that's a male-dominated research that went into that. Women weren't really part of that. And it's shaped how we manage our forests. That's what we do. It's all this, I call it one-eyed seeing. It's like we're looking at the forest with one eye closed. And so then when my work came around, it shows actually there's all this collaboration in forests, that there's networks that go on, that there's all this sharing. And they're just like, that can't be true. But it actually opens up the other eye, right? It's the female perspective. And we need to integrate these two things, the male and the female, for a more holistic practice that will honor all the connections and the competition and all the multifaceted and brilliant ways that we communicate with each other and interact with each other. But so far, you know, forest management has been so much about that dominance and competition, and you got to manage it and foster dominance. And I'm just like, you know, this is the opposite of what I think we should be doing, that we should be managing the whole ecosystem. It's more holistic, right? To look at it in these connections and relationships, and that, you know, that all of them matter, all the trees and creatures matter.
It's such a lesson for all of us, Suzanne, because who would think that, you know, diversity of thought, right? There's so much study on diversity of thought in different fields, but who would think that it even contributes to how we treat our ecosystem and how we see nature?
It does in a huge way. Yeah. Or the idea that we can dominate nature, right? You know, I remember when, you know, that one of, there was one American election and Mitt Romney was running in a primary to be the Republican nominee. And he said something that was like, he said, the role of man is to dominate nature. And I thought, that is so wrong. Right. Now, how did we get to that point? It is not to dominate nature. It's to be one and with and all part of nature. That's all we are. We're not here to dominate nature. And that's, but that thinking is so pervasive. And we don't even realize that's how we think. It's about exploitation and domination. And that runs right through how we, you know, weed our forests, how we space them, how we plant them with single species that we think are going to bring us more money. You know, it's clear-cutting our old-growth forests to make way for, it's all linked in there. It's all wrapped up together, and it's got to get untangled or at least get this other perspectives in there so that we have a better outcome. We have a better chance at surviving.
I feel like we could have talked to Suzanne for hours. I would have loved to have been her student as well. I know that immediately about her. I mean, I just loved the whole talk from the very beginning when she talks about spending her childhood in the forest. I mean, that's truly amazing.
But also, I mean, what really was amazing was the story we got to, right? Which is a story of how she basically says she gave herself cancer because she had to choose. She was forced to choose between her career and her children, literally, physically choose between them. Like, we talk about it metaphorically, like, oh, I can't be home for dinner, I'm on a business trip, but this was wildly different, and it sounds like her husband kind of forced her to choose that. But it was really exceptional, I thought, just to hear about how her kids perceive her career now. And perhaps there's no better sort of display of how they feel than the fact that they're both going into her field.
Right.
Amazing. Sam, we talk about that a lot in terms of being working mothers and what that means for our daughters and your son. And I think, like, that's just, it's a remarkable endorsement of who she is as a mother. Lou, what did you think?
I was just fascinated that she had so much information about trees. I was being straight up. I was just like, wow. You
know? I know.
Yeah. When you guys said, yeah, this is a person who knows trees, I'm like, wow. I like fungus talking and, you know, them like giving off a smell. It's like, you know, something that you see out of a fantasy book.
Will you ever look at a tree the same way again?
You know, there's some trees on my block that I've just been wondering how they do it, you know, because we just had a whole crazy time where I'm like now paying more attention because COVID has taken away a lot of distractions. So I go outside and in the wintertime, the leaves are all gone. And then now in the springtime, it's just blossoming. It's like really full of leaves. And I'm like, how did you all do that? Nobody's like watering you and fertilizing you. None of that, you know? They just have their own ecosystem. And she broke it down how it actually works. And I'm just like, ah. Oh. I even had a pillow. I'm sitting here just like, okay, this is education. She really taught me some stuff.
I love that.
That's awesome.
I can't remember any of the proper terms. I have to go Google them because there are some really long words. But yeah, it was very, very educational.
Yeah, she's pretty awesome.
Thanks for listening to What's Her Story with Sam and Amy.
We would so appreciate if you would leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, connect with us on social media at What's Her Story Podcast.
What's Her Story with Sam and Amy is powered by my company, The Riveter, at theriveter.co, and Sam's company, Park Place Payments, at parkplacepayments.com.
Thanks to our producer, Stacey Para, our social media manager, Phoebe Cranefuss, and our male perspective, Lou Burns.